Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's something you need to hear. Our wildlife is under attack like never before. In a new 12-part series, Charlie Moores and Ruth Peacey explore the concept of a war on wildlife. With special guests and short interviews with activists, researchers and campaigners, this one is not to be missed. Find it where you find podcasts, as well as on the free Lush Player app, and you can even follow at War on Wildlife on Twitter.
Hello, welcome. Welcome to Tiny Revolutions. So the idea behind this podcast is we are talking about comedy as a force for positive social change. And with that in mind, what more of a perfect first guest can I get than Chappie Corsandy? So let's have a little round of applause.
Thank you. I'm a bit worried, Tiffany. As you know, my nose has been growing lately. And I'm just really worried about the camera angle. Isn't that terrible? Would it be really awkward if I spoke to you like this? Is that natural? No. All right.
So Chappie is very, very easy for me to talk to because we've been friends for probably about 12 years since I first started in comedy. But Chappie is perfect for this show because she's someone who's always blended in a great fashion, I believe, the political and the personal. So I remember seeing one of your early sets on, I think it was like Michael McIntyre, where you talk about being Iranian and you speaking to your grandmother and being worried that she was going to get bombed. And her saying, well, it depends on when it happens because I'm just getting a new extension built.
Oh, so, I remember that show.
Yeah. So I can obviously do a version of the joke not as well as Chappie can. But I remember that being a very early example of seeing someone in stand-up who'd put together this kind of like a very, very personal take on political circumstance. So, you know, that's obviously always going to be part of what you do, right?
Never consciously, I have to say. I think I'm glad you reminded me of that joke. I like that one. I never ever write them down. Isn't that terrible? But I think at the time when I did that particular show, I was not long out of my 20s, and you know, having gone through a period of all of my youth with Iran and Iraq. At war, it was just a part of our reality that you had family in Iran that you never knew if they were going to be there when you woke up the next day. And you know, when you heard there were air raids in Tehran, then you spend all your time the next morning trying to call them. And of course, the telephone lines would be down, and that was our reality. Now, my reality happens to have been quite political, and I felt very much, like all new comedians do, that what's the thing about me that stands out the most? Like in London, I was kind of a bit more ordinary and normal. But then I'd, you know, go to, you know, a not a working man's club, but somewhere, you know, in Leeds.
Up north.
Somewhere up north.
I just immediately thought.
Where all, you know, and I was like, you know, 23-year-old girl starting out in comedy with my little West London accent and talking to these big, like, 40-year-old Yorkshire men that at the time seemed like twice the size and twice their age to a 23-year-old. And I was like, they're just going to be looking at me going, what on earth has this young, you know, Middle Eastern southerner got to say to us? And I found talking about myself and acknowledging that I did, you know, I wasn't going to, you know, be like their cousin or their niece or... So I think a lot of the time in comedy, people look for familiarity. They like comics who reflect their own life. They like comics who remind them of their grandma or their granddaughter or their Uncle Joe.
Sort of unconscious bias, isn't it?
And it's feeling at home with someone. And so when it comes to politics as well, then I found that people then liked what I do if they came from the left. Or they came from the right but were a bit racist and thought, oh, isn't it lovely that she's on the phone? You'd never know. she's one of the good ones. If only they were all like her. And I acknowledge feeling that, because those are feelings. Comedy is about emotion, right? So I would feel people like that, and I would say it. And then that becomes a political thing, because anything that is... you know, out of the ordinary, out of what is typical, is kind of political most of the time.
Yeah, I definitely feel like you, when you first start in comedy, you go out and you do jokes. It's about being funny. In the first instance, you're like, can I be funny for this period of time? And then as it goes on a bit longer, it's kind of about challenging people's perceptions or ideas and being a bit provocative and playful. And it's funny that you mentioned 40-year-old blokes in Yorkshire, because for me, they were the 40 and 50-year-old men up the creek, mm-hmm. where you talk about something a bit feminist and they go, I never thought about it like that, girl. I liked that, you know, and they'll all of a sudden you've just changed something imperceptibly. And I think that's what's so brilliant about what you do. I think you were the first person that I saw making jokes about that situation who was from it. Like, if we look at... Shappy's got an amazing book called A Beginner's Guide to Acting English.
Worst title ever, but it is a good book.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, weirdly, the cover of the book kind of makes it a bit look like chick lit. Don't take that.
I can't even... Do you know, I'm so proud of my book, that book, but I don't talk about it because the cover and the name make me cringe. But the inside bit, once you get part, the acknowledgements are incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So a little bit of potted history. If you can tell people sort of how you came to be in the UK in the first place, to give them a bit of...
OK, well, this is it, why my politics, of course, played a part, especially when I was newer, in my comedy, because you talk about yourself. So I came here as a refugee, child refugee. My dad's a writer, and they tried to kill him without overly being dramatic. And it's interesting right now...
I love how you've instantly gone, where can I get the comedy out of this? Let's not be overly dramatic. The horror of someone trying to kill my dad.
But you know, there's Rosie Cooper, the MP Rosie Cooper recently... we found out she was a target of a assassination plot by a far-right group. And I kind of wanted to write to her and say, I know how that feels, and I know that... They weren't able to do it. They were foiled because idiots were, you know, bragging about it in a pub. Rule one of being a terrorist, don't tell your friends down the pub. I wanted to write to her and I go, I know that this killing someone as a terrorist is the tip of the iceberg. The idea is to terrorise them and everyone like them, to shut them up, that this might happen to you if you speak out. And that never leaves you. And so when I was 11, we had to go into hiding because terrorists were sent to Iran to shoot my dad as he took my brother and I to school. And the plot was foiled by an informant, and Scotland Yard scooped us up, took us into a safe place, and then we moved back to London, and they gave my dad all this advice about how to stay safe, and my dad never adhered to any of it. We were still in the directory, you know, he still sort of took
out an ad.
Yeah.
No, here we are.
Our address and phone number was printed on the satirical newspaper that he published from home. So absolutely no security. He never took different routes to school. He was like, look, if they're going to get you... they're going to get you. But what it is instilling fear. Now, that fear. It's only as adults that we've been, my brother and I have been able to acknowledge how much it affected us. It it makes you feel so terrified all the time, like post-traumatic stress disorder isn't something to be taken lightly, but both my brother and I were diagnosed with it way, way, way later in our lives. And it's like, oh gosh, and all of us as a family. And I wanted to write to Rosie Cooper and just go, I kind of get how you, how can you put one, you know, just get on with days and get on with your job. It's you sit there and you go, but I'm a good person. I'm a nice person. How could people want to kill me? And this is what I was a kid, I was 11. And I think about these terrorists and go, my dad is the kindest person. He'd help you out. He'd find a mechanic. He couldn't fix your car himself because he just barely knows how to turn one on. But he'd find you a mechanic if you needed one. And it wrecks to an extent your trust in other people. And so when I first started stand-up, a lot of the residues of that were in it. And I kind of got quite disheartened when people were like, all she ever talks about was being Iranian. It's like, well, we all sort of, as comics, unravel ourselves. And the big thing in your life, whether it was a divorce, whether you were adopted, whether it was something out of the ordinary that set you apart, is what you're going to talk about.
Of course, because it's what makes you interesting on stage. It's kind of like a form of therapy as well. As well as being a force for social change, it's like, it is therapy, isn't it? You're just there sort of pulling your guts out. And also, the idea of there then being fear when you get on stage, when you had that fear, did it help? So with that fear in an early life, did it make you go, I'm going to get up here and say whatever I like, because essentially no. This isn't as scary?
Oh, Tiff, I was terrified. There was a broadsheet journalist who came to see the first show I did, which was called Asylum Speaker. And I talked about all this stuff. And he lied. He said she wanders around the stage with swilling her pint. And he didn't say it was a pint of water. And then at the end he said, oh, the thing she said, one wonders if she might not become a target like her father one day. My blood froze. I was in Edinburgh. You know, in Edinburgh, you're nuts anyway, right?
Yeah.
My blood froze. I was like, oh, my gosh, that I'm going to target now. And the next day, these four people with hijabs came to my show. I was like, oh, my God, they're from the embassy. They must be from the Iranian embassy. And that was when all the judges from the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I did my whole show, editing it as I went, you know, all but saying, I'm totally cool. And of course they weren't. And the reason they weren't laughing is because they couldn't speak English. And they were just very sweet tourists that had heard there's an Iranian comic on and they thought they'd come along and support me. But the whole time I thought they wanted to kill me. And I'm going to say this to you and hope that people understand the context, but what it did to me was gave me a real mistrust of openly Islamic people, because as a child, I thought they're the ones that want to kill us. And obviously, I was a child, so I can be forgiven for that. And I had parents to steer me through that. And I went to school with lots of Muslims and learned not to be an Islamophobic idiot. So now it's kind of tricky when we see so much Islamophobia. And I'm like, you really need to... As a child, I had to differentiate between political Islam and ordinary believers. And it's a very ugly thing to see how people are not doing that right now. And
do you I think as well your mind can be changed when you're younger? Do you think it's still possible, I mean, in the broader context of what this is about as well, that through something like comedy or through you being on stage or you talking about these experiences, people can... I find it's harder when people get to later in life, for example, you know, parents and grandparents. And sometimes we're very forgiving, aren't we? We go, oh, well, it's just their age. And you go, should it be, though? Should that not be challenged? Should we not, like, kind of, you know... Do you think there's ever a point where it's too late...
I don't think there is, because I think most people want to live in harmony. Most people don't want to spend their lives fighting. Most people want their kids to get on with other people's kids. It's when people peddle fear that it becomes a problem, and the internet is rife for that, you know.
I think it really... If you spend enough time on any of the social media like Twitter or Facebook. I mean, I have a story in my show that the one time I've actually racially profiled someone on a train with a backpack was the day after the London Bridge attacks, and I'd spent 5 hours reading Twitter the night before. And it's kind of like, it was almost like I'd been radicalised the other way. Like, because my school was like really, really multicultural. And, you know, we grew up like not far from each other in West London. So West London's pretty multicultural.
But, you know, is it irrational that you did that, that you racially profiled him? Is that an irrational thing? Because the fact of the matter is that we've got bombs going off in our big cities.
Yeah.
And terrorists have done their job of instilling us with fear, and therefore your instinct might be for a few days after an attack is go into a carriage where you can't see anyone that looks like the people.
Well, here was the thing.
I don't think that that's something we should beat ourselves up for.
I had a little panic because what actually happened was he sat opposite me, and then in my head I went, I feel really uncomfortable, I'm just going to move one carriage. But then I went, I'd literally rather be blown up than have someone think I'm racist.
Yeah.
Because at this moment in time, with what's happening politically, you know, like that's... this is something we've discussed before, but it feels like increasingly on the left at the moment, we are separated by all of our differences and the right are united in what they don't like. And it's the left that would pounce on you for doing that, for going, Tiffany, how dare you do that? Just because he's a brown man with a rucksack on the train doesn't mean he's going to be a problem.
No.
Well, it was actually because he had two mobile phones. Genuinely, he had two mobile phones. And that set off all kinds of alarm bells for me, because I'm like, who has two mobile phones apart from terrorists and drug dealers?
He was having an affair.
Oh,
he has
yeah.
lapsed morals. He wasn't a killer.
So you don't think it's too late for people to change that?
No, because it's about ignorance, isn't it? And
yeah.
So then you become better at not being ignorant. For example, on the other side of it, because when I was a kid, when people like racially abused my family, they would do it in a Cockney accent. It would be, you know, that's middle class people have the same prejudice, but it manifests in different ways, right? So, you know, packies, go home, whatever, was said in a Cockney accent by, you know, working class people. So for a long time, if I was on the tube and I heard working class accent, like as a sort of, you know, 14, 15-year-old kid, I'd be like, oh, my God, any minute now they're going to call me a packy. Any minute now they're going to say something really horrible and I'm with a boy I really fancy and I can't have someone call me a packy in front of this guy I really fancy from school because that would be so embarrassing. And so I had to then go, no, Shap, not every working class person.
You had to undo that prejudice.
I had to undo that. Not only did I have to undo that prejudice, I went to school with kids like that. So my accent, I sort of adopted a middle class accent quite early on because to me, it sort of made me less of a target because class trumps race every time. Isn't that terrible?
It's bizarre, isn't it?
But I was like, I do see that I am indeed a packy, but look how well-spoken I am. You know, and this is how a 9-year-old is trained to think, you know? And then you...
Well, comedy comes in early doors as a defence mechanism, doesn't it? I mean, that's been said about comedy a lot, but you're like, I can diffuse this if I make a joke out of it. I can take the awkwardness or the tension.
I couldn't at the time. I think at the time I just cried. But what I think... I don't know, I think being a stand-up is a disease, personally. That desire to go out again and again and again, no matter how badly the previous time went, is a compulsion. Had that said, I feel that it was such an important job for me to become professional in because it was my second chance at the playground. It was because, those jibes and stuff can make you feel so...
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Not in the gang, to say the least. Right, so you kind of create your own gang and then you kind of think, yeah, you know, I'm in this comedy club, I'm making you laugh.
I love that. I love second chance at the playground. Yeah. That's such a beautiful way of putting it. Because I've noticed, or it has been pointed out to me very delicately by my boyfriend, sorry, now fiancé, Gage now. Yeah, I know, it's very exciting.
I'm so glad you asked what I said, now we're not now, together. I was like, oh, no.
He'll be excited when he finds out as well. But he pointed out to me, often to get you to do something, all you have to do is say you can't do that.
Mm.
So mine is being told that I can't do a thing. It then becomes, I'll show you. I will do it. And I'll do better than everyone else, you know. But it really is about all that stuff that happened in your childhood. And kind of going, even if you had a nice childhood, just if you just didn't feel like you got enough love from one parent, that is enough to kind of drive you into the arms of stand-up comedy. But then I think the motives sort of change as you go along. Like, did you find, was there a point where you actively, because of what your dad does, so is it probably best to describe your dad as a satirist, really? Mm,
yeah.
Yeah. Did you think, I actively don't want to be political because that's what he did?
Mm. Oh, you know what? I think I tried to be more political because of him. And that was a mistake because I was trying to before I'd found my feet. And I think that my dad, now he's different. But when I first started, he'd come and see my shows and he'd say, but you didn't say anything. You didn't say anything. And, you know, everyone wants to, like, please their dad, right? Especially if you've had a dad like mine who's always been so busy. It's like, oh, I've got a kid. I'm interested in my kid because she's making me laugh. Great. Bored now. Go. I need to go. Yeah, my thing. So I did sort of try, no, dad'll like this, dad'll like that. And actually, it's nonsense because what my dad came to see me do a show, he hadn't come for years, and he came to see a show that I did that was massively about... have it, you know, a porn addiction and really graphic and honest sexually and about relationships. And my dad was in the audience the entire time. And afterwards he said, it was a very powerful feminist piece of work. Bravo, bravo. Aww. Well, you say, but I wish I'd had that at 23. You know what I mean? Now my parents have seen me sort of have two kids on my own, no man. They're a bit like, okay, got it. She's not going to do anything sort of conventionally. But that thing about moving on, like, for example, I think one of the biggest cultural challenges that we've had is attitudes and acceptance of trans people, right? And so... what's really interesting about when people, the older generation, my mum read a book about written by a trans woman in Farsi, the Iranian language. And she was telling me, because an old friend of hers is trans, and she was crying all the way through reading it. She goes, Shappy, if you knew what... And I just was quite heartened by that, because you'd think sort of a... 70-year-old woman, and then recently an old friend of ours at the age of 60 transitioned, and I told my parents because I saw it on Facebook, and my mum was like, I always knew that there was something inside that he was not able to express, and I just thought that's really kind of beautiful, and that she wouldn't have been like that 25 years ago even.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at university, she did think homosexuality was to get attention. You know what I mean? Oh, it's the fashion now, isn't it? It's the fashion. But she's grown, her world's grown. She's watched me, she's watched my brother, she's read, she's engaged. You know, she doesn't want her grandchildren, my kids, to live in a world where they hate anyone, so she's...
I think it sometimes comes down to when they can be personally affected or see or know someone that then minds can be changed. Having said that, my parents are in their 70s, and I was quite shocked at my dad's response. I did a show in Edinburgh one year called Cave Woman, and in it I told the story of the fact that when I was 17, I was pregnant, and he didn't know this.
Did you tell him
before
he came to the show?
I told him before he came to the show. I did say, look, something's going to come up in the show that you don't know about that happened, you know, a good, like, 18 years ago, 17 years ago. So I'm just giving you fair warning and, you know, so you're not shocked. And I didn't specifically say what it was. But then afterwards he came up and he was like, I'm really proud of you. And he sort of had tears in his eyes. And I was like, oh, like, I think sometimes our parents worry for us when we're so open about stuff and with jokes. And I imagine your dad has the same under the threat of death.
Yeah.
That he sometimes goes, oh, you know, Shappy, if you say that, that's going to be, you know, what might happen. Yeah. You know, is there any line that you ever kind of go to with your comedy where they go, maybe you need to ease off this because it's...
Yes, there is. It depends. My dad always says it's how much criticism you can handle afterwards. Because if you can't handle, you know, when you throw the rock in the pool, if you can't handle the ripples and, you know, the effect of it, then don't do it because it messes with your head. You know, you've got to look after your own head. You've got to... There's certain things that I do not engage in on social media because I know that it will invite an ocean of... hostility that you simply can't micromanage, you know, during your day. And then suddenly you find that your day on earth has been spent staring down at your phone, feeling all these emotions and having rows with strangers or trying to make your point with someone who is not interested.
Who's willfully misinterpreting what
you're
doing. Willfully
misinterpreting. And also, likewise, with comedy, I think that... there are certain political situations that I would save for a column.
Right, okay.
Rather than a stand-up set, because when you write something down on paper, you can be so much more nuanced sometimes, and you're not seeking an immediate laugh. And also, I am a comic, I'm not a satirist. And sometimes I've had, you know, people being really upset by something I've said on stage because they disagree with me. That's fine. I don't have any... I don't talk about Iranian politics. I don't talk about Iran at all anymore because, number one, I've said it, I've done it. It's not creatively interesting to me. But then, oh, my goodness, it's just... everyone's got something to say about the way that you have...
expressed yourself.
Presented something.
That's interesting that you say you would save it for a column, though, because that is another outlet or another way of reaching a different audience, because you write a column for The Independent,
don't you? And it can still be funny, although mine... Oh, God, when I start writing, I get so serious. my novel, don't read my novel. It so makes you cry. Don't read it. Read it. Please read it. Please read Nina's Not Okay.
But you're able to put across points in a way. But then having said that, I do even think that columns can be misread or, you know, I think sometimes we sort of question ourselves as to why we want to put a certain idea or a thought or something out there. But you had a great... I saw a great column of yours recently that was all about the hijab and women in Iran and why are we not supporting them.
I get really annoyed by that. I get really, really annoyed by the left not supporting women in Iran who took off their hijab. They leave all of that up to, you know, the...
You're just leaving the right to comment on it.
Absolutely.
If you don't... Right.
Absolutely. There seems to be this... reluctant to criticise political Islam. Certain things that are going on with the Iranian government, whether it's arresting women for taking off their hijab, whether it's our friend Nazneen Ratcliffe, who's been languishing in an Iranian prison for 4 years now, while her husband Richard is desperately trying to get support from Corbyn, from the left.
And do you feel it's more suitable to talk about that in a column on stage? Because I think we both talked about maybe the hijab on stage before. But do you find that actually that's a better vehicle if you want to talk about something like that than broaching it on stage?
I think.
Do you think the audience feel like attacked or?
No, I think with me, I'm taking a break from stand-up at the moment because I want to come back and talk about much more party political stuff that I have been in the last sort of few years. I think because I am from Iran, it sounds better coming from me, perhaps more palatable to people, because I know people agree with me, but there's people are so terrified. Like, it will take one... Like, my friend, I'm going to tell you about this. My friend Jenny Colgan, she's a writer, and she was writing a review of Nadia from Bake Off's book.
Right, yeah.
Now, authors... it's a bit of a bugbear for them having celebrity writers, celebrity novelists. So she was coming, Jenny, my friend, was coming from a point of standing up for unknown authors who write brilliant stuff, but they don't get publishing deals, but somebody from a popular TV program has one on her lap. And she said it just seems a bit greedy that amongst all the other things that she's got out of this program, she also wants a book to take up the shelves. Sadly, I wasn't in the country when she was getting grief on Twitter because I would have fought her corner tooth and nail. But she got accused of being racist. She got accused of not understanding how young Muslim girls might feel, mostly by other white women, I have to say.
Whose behalf are you being offended on? This is a question that comes up a lot of the time.
Absolutely. And that really upset me because I've known this woman for more than 20 years. And to criticise someone, but I'm sorry, but you're white, aren't you, love? You're white, so if you criticise someone who isn't white, then we're going to call you a racist. That is a problem that we have at the moment, is shutting down something that someone's got to say. Sometimes, you know what I found interesting was sometimes I stick up for unpalatable causes and I don't get the grief that, you know... a white comic might get, because people tiptoe around me a bit more. I believe that, because they're so terrified that someone will call them a racist. Is that a weird thing to admit?
I remember there was sort of some spats on Twitter. I do want to talk about one cause which you support, where we actually, again, coming back round into sort of comedy for social change, because you work with a company called Let Toys Be Toys. And I know you've spoken about this on stage, haven't you?
Mm.
About having kids and letting them play with whatever toys they want to play with.
Let's take
the gendering out of toys. So that
a girl doesn't need pink Lego.
Yeah. Yeah, she just wants Lego. Yeah. She just wants to build. So you've spoken about that on stage, haven't you?
Yeah.
And then you teamed up with this...
Yeah, just
like a little grassroots organisation, right?
Absolutely. Let Toys Be Toys. They campaign against sort of boys' toys, girls' toys. And, you know, and actually what I did say, because John Lewis now doesn't have boy clothes department and girls clothes department. It's really annoying.
Have you shot yourself in the foot?
No. The bigger picture is wonderful. The bigger picture, but if you do have a kid that loves unicorns, you're like, where's the unicorns?
Who doesn't love unicorns?
Yeah, and then some people, high-profile people, sort of took my support of that to sort of put me down. Like,
I saw that.
She's got nothing better to talk about than pink toys and blue toys. Like, well, I've got lots of other things. If you'd like to have a coffee with me, I'll explain.
Yeah, but I feel like... that is whataboutism. It's whataboutery, isn't it? It's kind of going, aren't there more important things to worry about, Shappy? And we can say that was a man, another comic, that did that. And I find that very, very interesting, as if we're only capable of caring about one thing at a time. Someone once said to me when I complained about something at a festival to, you know, someone that worked at the festival, someone replied with, Syria? Like, literally, like, as if, you know, as if, like, why don't you think about that and just stop your complaining?
Do you know, I think that's really interesting, because people's heads are at different places. Like, I've had certain sort of situations where I you know, like I can't, sometimes I can't believe people are walking around being normal when Nazanin Ratcliffe's still in prison in Iran. And I have to remember, Shafi, this is your thing. Everyone's got their thing and you just have to do the best you can and campaign the best you can. But the really important thing about comedy and music, I think comedy and music kind of go hand in hand on this, is I don't know if you change minds. You know, I very, very much doubt that if Tommy Robinson came to one of my shows, he'd go out thinking, do you know what, I'm gonna join Humanist UK and volunteer at a soup kitchen. I doubt he would do that. However, what you might get is people who have stuff bubbling under the surface that they don't feel they can say out loud. And then when you're a comic that they like and you say those things, then there's that beautiful word, empowerment. They feel empowered to then be able to stand their ground when their boss is being, you know, inappropriate or whatever. Because I remember absolutely feeling like my world lit up and became technicolor when I saw, you know, Ben Elton, which I know now that, you know, he doesn't have the same sort of political reputation as he did back then. But when I was 12 years old, 13 years old, this guy that talked about politics in a way that I didn't even know I agreed with. There were like instinctive things that I felt that I was like, yes, that's my team. I'm going to follow this team. And I watched everything he did and I got into the young ones and I got obsessed with, you know, any comic that was like George Carlin, Richard Pryor, comics that talked about social issues were... My God, they were very important to me in my self-confidence as a young person, you know, shaping my worldview. And that came from comedy and massively music. Billy Bragg. I go to see Billy Bragg as often as I can, because if too much time goes without me seeing him, I really lurch to the right. I always need Billy
to steer him back. Well, I think...
I just realised what colours I'm wearing.
You and your conservative dress,
yes. Yes, I'm going to a tea party after.
I was going to ask, actually, it's interesting that you went down that sort of road of you may find someone who's got something bubbling under the surface. I think that's one of the beautiful things about comedy. If you talk about stuff that's rarely talked about or something that's very personal or some demon that you're battling, you'll often get an email from someone who's seen you at a show. So I just wondered if you would share something that you've received, like an email or after a show, someone said... Hey, by the way, thank you for speaking about
that. Nice thing.
Yeah, yeah, like a nice thing. Not a... yeah. So the nicest... Like an email where someone said, thank you for talking about Iran, or talking about
all of
bisexuality,
that,
for example.
All of that. You see, the bisexual thing's really interesting, because I never spoke about it, because even like my closest friends think I'm being a bit silly. It's really weird. I should have properly come out a lot earlier, but it was really tricky. So now I'm in a situation where I'm sort of, my bisexuality is mostly theoretical. But I did feel as more and more sort of people were being really open about things, I just thought, oh, well, this is like a little thing of mine that I don't really talk about. Like, all my friends know that I've been out with a couple of girls, but I've never talked about it or anything. So I've started to, and I'm still finding my feet.
So I haven't just outed you to a room
full
of...
No, it's fine. But the Iranian thing, I remember going to see Omid Jalili when I was 20 in a show that he did called Short Fat Kebab Shop Owner's Son.
Great title.
And I know... And I went to see it, and it rocked my world, because that door of entertainment business, show business, seemed so firmly shut to me. It seemed so closed to, like, this fat, frizzy-haired sort of, you know, girl that come out of university thinking, I'm going to go to Tamil Nadu and eradicate female circumcision. That's what I thought I would do with my life, but I couldn't get it together to fill in a form. Anyway.
But yet you've done Edinburgh shows.
I know. I saw him and I wrote him a letter and I hand-delivered it to the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith. And I left my phone number And I said, I want to be a comedian. And he phoned me and he said, listen, just do it. There's lots of little comedy clubs. I wrote to 10 of them and only one of them came saying, I can do an hour for you. I've just been the toast of the Edinburgh Festival. And only one person got back and said, yeah, you can have 5 minutes at Bearcat on a Saturday night. And that gave me so much confidence. So I've had people writing to me saying that, you know, it's just really mad to see someone with your background. I really relate to the fact that you're out there being vocal and, you know, whatever. So that's always nice. And with Nina's Not Okay, I get addicts writing to me a lot. And they're much more personal and much more, you know, the response is an email, not a Instagram message.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that's a kind of, that's an amazing thing that makes you feel that it's the same. People did that for me too. You know, Omid Jalil did that to me. Richard Pryor in America, without knowing so, he opened a door for me in some ways about honesty and truth. I will never be as close to him in honesty and truth, but that's what we all strive for as stand-ups.
Yeah.
Is to get as close to the truth as possible. And it's so hard. It's so hard. You have to unpick so many layers of yourself. And
well, there's some things you don't want to acknowledge about yourself, even as a stand-up, where you go,
like,
I'm
I can't
open.
Pull women. I'm not interested. Men are just turn up. Women, not interested. That sounded way more arrogant than I meant it to. I was in a room full of 20-somethings, so, all right, Grandma.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.